I'm going to get started. I ask you to quiet down a little. Those who haven't yet, we're going to pray and dive in. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for your continued blessings and mercy, your great love and favor. We just thank you for having anything to do with us at all, but loving us the way that you do, providing for us the way that you do, giving us time and space, giving us all the resources that are available to us to serve you and to magnify Christ. And we thank you for bringing us to this time and in this day and allowing us this safe place to think together and to study your word. We ask your blessings in a special way on all the teachers who invest themselves and all the students who diligently prepare. Help us to engraft your word to our hearts, toward the saving of our souls. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. All right, we've been thinking about the Song of Solomon for a couple of weeks now, diving in earnest last week, and we were able to cover chapter 1, and I think just that first verse in chapter 2 we touched on, and this is a continuation when we pick up at verse 2, so I want to just remind you a little bit, think with you for just a moment or two about what we were looking at in chapter 1. So in this chapter 1, we see these initial confessions of love. We see the maiden, the bride, and she's explaining how highly she thinks about Solomon, the one who she's going to marry. And of course, he reciprocates and repeatedly talks about the things that he likes about her. One of the interesting things that I think you have to pick up on in reading the book, and especially in this first chapter, are her sort of insecurities. And if you think about the difference in the stations of the two people we're talking about, okay, we've got the king of Israel with all of his splendor, all of his riches. He can have any woman he wants, okay? And then we have this maiden who is used to working out in the fields and whatnot. I mean, this is not a lady who comes from great substance. And she has some insecurities, okay? And that is on full display for us in the first chapter. And so he spends some time trying to assure her that he wants her, that he loves her, that he thinks she's beautiful, she's worthy of his time, worthy of his attention, his affection, and so forth. As we ended in this first chapter, he had affirmed her beauty and so forth, and so she has responded as she does and says how much she thinks he's attractive and so forth. If it is a pet name, she refers to him as her beloved continually. And at the end of that chapter, she talks about a special place, a garden place, where they could go and have some quality time together. I sort of said to you, I mean, it could be that she's romanticizing about, you know, the physical relationship that they would have in the future. It's possible. It's not necessary. It's just possible. But she's got in her mind a special place. And isn't it nice, you know, in a marriage relationship, if you have a special place, you know, where you and your spouse maybe can go on a long walk and be together and have some quiet time. She's got something like that in her mind. Now, it is possible that she's thinking about a physical home. I just don't think it is literal. I think it is figurative. But if somebody wanted to entertain the possibility that she's describing the actual roof of an actual building, well, that's fine. I wouldn't argue with you about it. But at the end of the chapter, or I said in chapter 2 and verse 1, This was a continuation of her thoughts that she gave in response to him. And we mentioned it at the beginning, at the end of last class. I want to pick up with it. You remember she says, and this is the ESV I've got today. She says, "I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys." And I suggested to you that what she's communicating there is, okay, you've told me that I'm beautiful and I'm going to accept your compliment, but she's going to qualify her acceptance of it by saying, okay, well, maybe I have some beauty, but there's certainly nothing uncommon about it, okay? A lily or a rose, and we use these terms, we have an image in our mind that may or may not be the flower that she was actually referring to, but okay, a flower in the field, an individual flower is beautiful, but it's not uncommon in a field of flowers, okay? That's what she's kind of communicating here. And Solomon is going to once again affirm her. Now look at what he does. He uses the same imagery that she has in verse number 2. As a lily among brambles or thorns, so is my beloved among the women. She says, yeah, I may be beautiful, but nothing uncommon about my beauty. And he says, no, you've got this image all wrong. You are saying you are one flower among many, and I'm telling you that you are a flower among thorns. And he makes it very clear that he's comparing her to other women. So is my love among the young women. He is telling her that she is one of a kind. No woman compares to her. Now, he's saying this to her against the backdrop of her insecurities and her sort of wanting to qualify her beauty and her being fitting of his attention. He says, listen, there's not another like you in the whole world. He goes out of his way to affirm her. And I want to just make a point here as we think about this, for those of us who are married, those of us who may be contemplating marriage, you know, sometimes you will know because of your relationship with your spouse that your spouse has certain insecurities, is insecure about certain things. And I want to remind you that it is dangerous to have an unduly low self-esteem. Now, we are always on guard for somebody having unduly high self-esteem, okay? But it is also dangerous for a person to have unduly low self-esteem. That is to think less of themselves than God would have them to. Not to value themselves as a person created in the image of God. Not to value themselves as one for whom Christ died, and not to value themselves as one who could be attractive to someone else. Well, in a marriage relationship, that can have a lot of very unfavorable ramifications, and I don't want you to underestimate that. Solomon sees that, and he sees the need to redress it, and so he is consistent, he is persistent. He insists that this woman is attractive to him, and I think it'd be wise for us to have that same kind of persistence and insistence in our relationships where we see that our spouses may have a lower esteem about themselves, a lower self-image than they should. Who better? Than their spouse, the one who knows them best, to help them in that area. And Solomon is doing his level best to do that here. In verses 3 through 7, I want to read that together because now we have her responding to what he has just said. He's only got the one verse in response to all that she said, and now she's going to have a longer response again. In verse number 3, as an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. With great delight I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you stir not up or awaken love until it pleases. This is the bride's response to what Solomon has said. Now you see they go back and forth in terms of their complimenting one another and extolling the virtues of one another. And so he has just told her, listen, you are a flower, a lily among the thorns. You're special. There's not another like you. She says much the same thing to him using some different imagery. Now she says in verse number 3 that he is an apple tree among the trees of the forest. And again, it's obvious this is a comparison between him and other men. So are you among the young men. You are special. You are one of a kind. Different imagery, the exact same message being conveyed. An apple tree. This may not be the apple that we have in our minds, okay? It's the fruit of a tree, the fruit of a fruit-bearing tree. You don't usually find fruit-bearing trees in the forest, do you? I mean, some of you, I know you're an arborist, you would know, okay? You don't usually go out in the forest and, like, I've got some woods right around my house. We got a few acres out there, and I've walked all over it. I haven't found one bearing fruit yet. Okay, that's not usually the way this works. And so an apple tree in the midst of the forest would be a unique thing, a special thing. And that's what she is conveying to him. He also is one of a kind. How do you think about your spouse? You know, how do you think about your spouse? I'll tell you, when they made Sister Ote, they broke the mold, only one of her. She's a small package, but a stick of dynamite, I'm telling you. There's only one of her, and she's mine. She led me to Christ. She bore both my children. And she is a virtuous woman. There's only one of her. She's special to me. Now, your wife should be special to you. There's only one of them. Your husband should be special to you. There's only one of him. And you may want to communicate that sometimes. That's what we see happening here. He tells her how special she is, and she affirms him and says how special he is to her. And so she uses this tree imagery. Okay. She carries forward with that and says that she delights in his shadow or his shade. She delights in being in his presence. Okay, under the shadow that's provided by the tree, the shade provided by the tree, the protection provided by the tree. If you looked at this word that's translated shadow here, and I give you a couple of verses that you could look at where this most of the time is translated shadow or shade. But there are a couple of occasions, and I've given you a couple, where it's translated in a way that has to do with protection, security. If you looked at Numbers 14 and verse 9 for just a moment, you'll see what I mean here. In Numbers chapter 14 and verse number 9, only do not rebel against the Lord and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. You remember this is the spies. Their protection is removed from them and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. That word, their protection, that's the same word. Their shade, their shadow. You see the same thing in Ecclesiastes 7, verse 12, talking about wisdom being a protection, being a shadow, a shade. And so that's the idea that she's communicating. Listen, she delights in being in this man's presence, okay? This man is a protection, a covering for her. And isn't that the way a wife ought to feel about her husband? I mean, when she's in his presence, she ought to know that she is taken care of, she's secure, she's protected. He makes her feel that way. Now, she also makes reference here to, she says, the sweetness. His fruit is sweet. I'm sorry. You know how it is. In my Bible, the American Standard Version I usually use, I know where the words are on the page. I mean, it's just I've got an image of it in my mind. So I'm using this little one here, and I've got to search for some things. Okay, but his fruit was sweet to my taste. Could be that she's thinking about being intimate with him. She's anticipating that. There's a whole lot of anticipation here, and it's obvious that she finds him desirable, and he finds her desirable, and then she's thinking about that. Now, if you look at verse 4, we've got a certain setting here that I want to make sure that you see. She says that he brought me to the banqueting house. And his banner over me was love. Well, what's a banqueting house? It depends on the translation that you, or if you look at it, this could be translated a wine house, okay? But it's translated a banqueting house for a reason, because if you were to, you know, when the king, you've seen some references in the Bible where it talks about people who ate at the king's table, and we're talking scores of people, right? I mean, it's huge numbers of people because they didn't sit at a dining room table like I have, okay? He had a hall, you know, maybe as big as this auditorium. And she's saying, okay, he has me into the banqueting house, the place where he has the people who are important to him come and assemble. And his banner over me is love. Now, what's a banner for? What's a banner? Come on now. It's not rhetorical, and it's not a trick question. What's a banner for? Okay, it identifies, it draws attention, right? If we were to have some special occasion here at the congregation and we wanted the community to know about it, you know what we might do? Plant a flag out there and put a banner on it so everybody knows. He's advertising his love for her in the midst of a group of people who are pretty influential and important to him. Now, who is this lady? Well, she's a maiden who's spent the better part of her days working out in the field somewhere, and she's ushered into the company of some pretty important people, and this guy is doting all over her, letting the world know how he feels about her. I mean, there's some limitations to public displays of affection, right? But when I sometimes say to people, act like you know each other. You know, if you're husband and wife, people ought not to have to try to figure out if you're brother and sister or husband and wife. Okay, he's making it clear how he feels about her. She has his attention in the midst of this assembly, and everybody knows it. His banner, his display, he's calling attention to the fact that he loves this woman. She is the object of his love. And so now she says in verse 5, sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. The lady says, I need some sustenance here. I need some food. She is spent. She's sick with love. She is lovesick. This idea of being lovesick has to do with missing someone to the extent and degree that you cannot function normally. You're thinking about them. They're consuming all of your thoughts, and you're longing for this object of your love sort of disrupts your daily routine or your ability to accomplish what you need to get accomplished in a given moment in time. Anybody ever been lovesick? You don't have to raise your hand, because I know you have. There's a place for this. There's a place for this. In marriage, you know, you can't stand to be apart from your spouse. You just, boy, I just landed, and boy, I wish I was back there with you. I just got here, and I've got to be here for another week, but I miss my wife. You know, I want to be with you, and what are you doing? Well, I just got off the phone with you, and now you're texting me, asking me what I'm doing, because I can't think about anything else. There's a place for this. You know where it might not be the place for it? You're 15-year-old. Because that's what happens. Everybody's got to make their own decisions, but you know what? Some people are not mature enough to handle this kind of thing. And when you dispatch young people out into the world and allow them to get involved in what I call grown folks' business, these romantic relationships, I'm sure you have seen it. If you haven't experienced it yourself, people whose grades fall through the ground, they just come completely irresponsible because they cannot handle these kinds of feelings. And you know why they can't handle it? Anybody got a wild guess why they can't handle it? Yeah, because they're not supposed to. They're not mature enough. But this has a place in marriage. Marital love is supposed to be intense like this. That's what we see. Now, she also mentioned that she's thinking about him, holding her and embracing her. I'll just say to you, it may or may not be something sensual that she has in mind. I hold my wife, and it doesn't have to be something sensual. I mean, I'm sure that all spouses in here hold one another from time to time, and it doesn't have to be a sensual moment in order to do that. Some commentators would sort of try to press the idea that it is, but I would say to you that it doesn't have to be, and if it is, in the context of these people betrothed to one another, soon to be married, there's nothing wrong with some controlled anticipation of their being together. Thoughts or questions about those things? All right, well, in the next verse, she says to these daughters of Jerusalem, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Okay, these gazelles or roes, depends on the translation used. I use a couple different ones, and they go back and forth, gazelles, roes, does, and so forth. But if you look at the context of the book, and I gave you some verses here, you can see that these two animals are often referenced in sort of allusions to physically intimate interactions or body parts. Okay, so I can't tell you, other than the context of the book, why she's saying it this way, I adjure you by these animals. I don't know what that would mean or why that would be significant, except that in the book, these two animals are repeatedly referenced in that kind of context. And then she says that you don't stir up love until it pleases. Now here again, depending on what commentary you're fond of looking at, you know, you'll find some people trying to say that, okay, this is suggestive of the aftermath of a physical interaction, okay, and she's saying, listen, don't disturb him until he's ready to be disturbed. Listen, that is outside the context of where we are in the book. You remember, where are we in the book? In their relationship, where are we? We're in the courtship phase. What has she just told us? What she's just told us is that she is exhausted. She's lovesick. She needs nourishment now, because she has been completely enveloped, her mind and her emotions in her feelings for the object of her love, okay? And so I don't believe that that's what's happening here. It doesn't fit the context of the book. It's completely out of order to make that kind of a suggestion. But what we do have here is her speaking to these daughters of Jerusalem. She says it very specifically, that you don't stir up love or awaken love until it pleases. Now, what does that mean? Don't rush it. Don't rush it. Because it is exhausting. It is sort of overwhelming at times, the kind of feelings that she has for this man. So don't rush it. Don't rush it. Let things take their sort of natural course. And if you do that, you may wind up at this place. But don't run out sort of recklessly trying to get to this place. Anybody ever seen people do that? Sort of recklessly pursue love and what that does to their life. I've seen it. And I believe this is an admonition that ought not to be done. Ought not to be done. We don't have any questions or thoughts about that part of it. I'm happy to hear it. If we do, if we don't, then at verse 8, then we're going to make a transition. Okay, we've sort of been going back and forth with their pronouncements of love for one another and their extolling one another's virtues and so forth, Solomon's repeated affirmations. Okay, now in verse 8, we take a transition here. And so I want to read from 8 to 17, that is the through the end of this chapter, and this will take up the rest of our time. The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. For behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig trees ripen its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. O my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the crannies of the cliff, let me see your face, let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine, and I am his. He gazes among the lilies. He grazes among the lilies until the day breathes and the shadows flee. Turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on cleft mountains. So this whole episode here has to do with him visiting her. Okay, because you can see here in the beginning, she says, "The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes." Okay, so this is him paying her a visit. And these first couple of verses have to do with his arrival. Now, listen, before he actually makes it to a place where he can communicate with her, she hears, "He comes, the voice of my beloved." Okay? She is excited by that. "Behold, take a good long look. My beloved is coming." And as he comes, she's excited by his coming, and he is excited by going to visit her. He is, listen, he's not doing it the way I would do it, taking a leisurely stroll. This guy is leaping and dancing. This guy is excited to see her. She is excited, and so is he. She makes reference to his visage. That is, the vision, his appearance. She makes reference to it and says that it is like a gazelle or a stag. Now, there's a lot of animal imagery here, okay? So if you're not an animal, person, some of this may be lost on you, right? What's the significance of the reference to a gazelle or a stag? Well, I mean, these are beautiful animals, okay? If you're a person who can appreciate natural beauty, you know, these are beautiful animals. And they are graceful animals. You know, there's just probably a lot of deer all around here, but, you know, outside the city, I mean, deer are everywhere. And every now and again, I get to see them in action. You know, they walk into my backyard and all that. But if you startle them and you see how they move, I mean, these animals obviously are powerful and quick, but very, very graceful. It's like they could like jump onto the top of a bucket and stand there. It's amazing how the balance they have and all that. Well, this is what she sees as he is approaching her. And so it's an impressive figure that he strikes. In verses 8 and 9, we can see him making his way toward her. And this may be a playful moment. I don't want to make too much of this, but you see how it says that he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice. Why didn't he just come up to her and start having a conversation? Well, sometimes, you know, there's something intriguing about Romeo and Juliet, he's calling up to the window, or is that Cyrano? That's Cyrano, isn't it? Well, it's both of them, I think. Okay, but there's something playful about him standing behind a lattice where he would be obscured and kind of speaking to her through some kind of obstruction like that. Don't want to make too much of that, but he is speaking through this lattice. And what does he say? Okay, in verse number 10, he says, she says of him, "My beloved speaks and says to me." So this is her recounting what he says. "Arise, my love." That's what he refers to her as, his love, my love, repeatedly in the book. She calls him my beloved, and he calls her my love. "Behold, my love," and look what he says again, "my beautiful one, arise and come away." Now he's going to say to her again, in verse number 13, at the end of it, "Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away." And so the point of his address to her is that he wants to have some time with her. He wants her to leave where she is and come away with him. He wants to have some private time with her. He wants some quality time with her. He doesn't want to visit with her in the midst of a whole bunch of people. He says, "Listen, come with me." Now, as he does that, he does it in a way that ought to probably put most of us to shame. You see how he describes the springtime here? I just don't have it in me to do it this well. But he talks about the fact that the winter time has passed, and then he describes the beauty of the spring. The winter has passed, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree ripens its figs, the vines are in blossom, they give forth fragrance. He says, arise and come away with me. Obviously, he's got a way with words. And he is, I mention this because maybe I'm not the only fella in here who could use the reminder that he is initiating some private time with her. He's not sort of begrudgingly willing to turn off the game long enough to have a conversation, right, which is not unusual, right? The wife has to say, listen, can you look at me while we're talking? This isn't that guy. He's the one who's initiating some private time. And fellas, it's important to do that. It's important to do that. Yes, ma'am. Do we know how old they are? We don't know. Most people think that this is likely early on in Solomon's life, right? Before he would have had 1,000 wives. This would have been early on. Just because we know the kind of sort of corruption in his heart that took place after he acquired all those wives. I think it's 1 Kings 11. He loved many strange women, and they led his heart away from God. And so most people, it's just a matter of conjecture, think this would have been very early on. Earlier in his life, he had a more godly attitude. And so most people think it would have been early on. He was a young man. You remember when he became king, he was very tender in years. I can't remember exactly now, but maybe 18 or 20, something like that. Because when David was about to die, you remember he made a remark about just how young Solomon was. And he made all those preparations for the building of the temple. Solomon was too young to do that. David made all those preparations for him before he died. So he'd have been a young man. I can't tell you exactly, but most people think he'd have been pretty young, in his early 20s or something. Yes, sir. Okay. Brother Bob makes reference to the end of chapter 3, the actual ceremony, and it talks about, let's see, in verse 11. Go out, O daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. You know, Bob's saying, well, you know, if he was an older man, this may not have been happening, right? Where his mother, maybe she'd have been alive, maybe she wouldn't, but maybe she would not have been crowning him if he had been as established on his throne for a long period of time. And, you know, he's got 700 or 800 of these. If he's an older man, is his mom going to do this every time? Maybe not. Right, because we remember now, most of the marriages that he had were political marriages. This one is quite different. So all of that to say, sister, I cannot assure you about his age. Most people think this would have been earlier in his life because of what we know about his life. His mindset here, it would seem to fit better with the earlier part of his life. Thank you for that. So he makes this address, and in doing that, he talks about her beauty again, calls her the beautiful one, and he, again, notice this. I'm hoping to give myself, okay, myself and the rest of you, but the guys in particular, because I think maybe we need it. He's being very specific, again, about what he appreciates about her. Now, you remember before he makes comment about her eyes. Okay, now he makes comment about her face, and he makes a comment about her voice as well. He calls her my love. That's typical. But he also calls her my dove, which I think is interesting. Verse 14, oh, my dove. Now, I want to make a comment about this, the use of pet names or terms of endearment, you know, in a marriage relationship. I think these things typically arise naturally, organically. You know, you kind of develop some little name, you know, for your spouse or something. Now, you certainly don't have to, but I just want to suggest to you that they can be sometimes a fun part of a romantic relationship, you know, an affectionate name that you might use. And who else knows it? Well, nobody else knows it. Nobody else really knows why you use it except the people who are involved, you know, where it comes from. Or there may be some, you know, something that only the two of you know, and that gives genesis to one of these pet names or something like that. But Now listen, you can have nicknames in any relationship, but there's something about a marriage relationship where only two people know what's going on that can be fun and can be pleasant. And so don't be ashamed to try it. Don't tell me the name, right? But between the two of you, don't be ashamed to try it. Verse 15, I want to confess to you freely that I think it's a difficult... I told you there's some verses in here where I cannot be sure, and I don't feel strongly enough to say I'm pretty sure who is speaking in a given verse. And verse 15 is one of them. I'm not sure who is speaking in verse 15. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom. As I read the book, it could be that she is the one who's doing the speaking, but she has been recounting what Solomon said. So is it that she's recounting what he said, or is this her making this comment on her own? Hard for me to say. Whichever position somebody would take on that, I'm not prepared to be dogmatic about it. The other thing that can be difficult to me is she makes reference, or the reference is made, to these vineyards. Okay, well, what vineyards are we talking about? Are we talking about physical vineyards, or are we talking about their relationship, their love, or are we talking about her body? Okay, I don't think we're talking about physical vineyards. That's the word that's being used, so I'm mentioning that. I don't think that's what we're talking about. I think we're talking about something figurative here. I see two hands. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, so in the ESV, it has it the same way. But sort of what I'm getting at is, I'm not sure. Well, I don't think it makes a big difference, okay? But I'm saying, is this what she is saying, or is this what she is saying that he said? Either way, the words are coming from her. Are they her words, or is she ascribing the words to him? Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Says her brothers. Okay. Yeah, so, but everybody has to, like in the ESV, they have these headings and stuff. It's a guy like me who sat down and wrote some headings. So we could have a bunch of discussion about that. I don't know exactly. Yeah, well, you remember we talked about people sometimes try to insert some different parties into the book, and I don't think there's a good faith basis for doing that. I don't think there's a good faith basis for injecting her brothers into this right here. But Some people have tried to do that. But here's what I do think is the case, though. Whatever the specific context is, I get the big idea. The big idea is there are sometimes disruptive influences that if we don't deal with them right now, they're going to lead to some real problems later. So if she's thinking about, or he is thinking about, their relationship, okay? Listen, we got, now she's talking, or I keep saying she, but these foxes, we got to get our hands on these foxes and deal with that so they don't spoil the vineyard, okay? There's some things in our relationship that if we don't get a handle on them right now, they're going to cause some real problems. Or, you know, if she's thinking about her own chastity and so forth because of her desires and all, listen, we need to take certain precautions here to make sure that we don't cross lines that ought not to be crossed. You know, an ounce of prevention, worth a pound of cure, right? That's the general idea. Well, we'll stop there. We didn't get verses 16 and 17, but we'll do that and keep going into chapter 3. Next, hey, listen, next